Hi and welcome back to the shortest history of Britain. In this episode we're going to be exploring the 1200s, the 13th century. Now as always, there were wars left, right and centre. There's bloodshed aplenty. We do start to see the kings and the rulers holding their positions for longer, so we're not jumping around from king to king with quite the frequency of previous episodes. The kings of England were able to make far more of an impact with the longevity of their reigns, but there was plenty going wrong for them and many lessons to be learned. So we entered the 13th century with John, the younger brother of Richard the Lionheart, taking the throne as King of England just before the turn of the century. Now, John was no Richard. The military prowess and courage of the older brother had given him that great name, the Lionheart, a fantastic testament to the man and one that rings loud even today. John, on the other hand, had been mockingly called John Lackland, originally, as he wasn't due to inherit any land. And then, as he ascended to the throne, he was given the name John Softsword, again a rather mocking title which summed up his reputation amongst his people of England and amongst the ruling barons. The succession to Richard's crown had again caused conflict between England and Normandy, between the new King John and Arthur I of Brittany. Now Normandy, as any of you who may have visited will know, is a very flat land with no significant natural defences, no ravines, mountains, there's no great forests, etc. And so the power in defending Normandy lay in constructing great castles, such as the Chateau Gaillard on the banks of the Seine, and they were all constructed at huge cost. The ability to win wars was becoming harder and harder, and the leaders of the time were becoming increasingly reliant on the hiring of mercenaries, soldiers of fortune, men who were in battle for personal profit only. John advanced into Normandy, but with both sides very well equipped, or alternatively, neither side well equipped enough to sweep a victory, they negotiated a truce with John of England and the French Arthur I, who had the support of King Philip of France, both ending the war without great bloodshed. Indeed, it was this moment that got John the name Softsword. Certainly, the contrast that showed to his older brother Richard the Lionheart. And so back home, John's expedition into Normandy, from which he'd returned largely empty-handed, was seen as a blow to both the prestige of the English throne, but also financially too. It had cost an extortionate amount of money to take a fleet of troops across with the boats and the men. And the leaders of the regions of England, the ruling barons as they were, saw it as cause for an uprising, a rebellion to John's power. King John was adamant that he would retake Normandy, and he spent the large part of the following decade orchestrating various moves in order to do just that. He created a huge army, a huge fleet of ships, with the sole purpose of using them in the wars across the Channel. He positioned these ships at what were known as the sunk ports, the five ports: Hastings, New Romney, Hythe, Dover, and Sandwich, though the port at Portsmouth was also greatly enlarged at this time as well to hold many more ships. And so, by the end of 1204, John had 50 large galleys, these huge slender boats which were powered by lines of oarmen on either side. They were the favoured warships of the Greek and the Romans in their time too, very, very powerful boats and great for war at sea. They would have held catapults and cannons and been equipped to ram other vessels, these great wooden battering rams on the front designed to plough into other ships. By 1212, another 50 ships were built, and John was finally ready to advance. He had been to and from Normandy over the previous years, taking cities and then losing them again, the advantage shifting backwards and forwards between the belligerents. Truces had been drawn, and then the truces had been broken. The French, in turn, planned to invade Flanders and then to press ahead with the invasion of England. And John was forced to take his fleet to sea to meet them. And whilst he was successful in destroying King Philip's armada, his fleet of ships, the years were slowly ticking away. Without John's great plan to take Normandy and beyond back for himself ever really being enacted. And so back in the other lands of Britain, the Welsh were planning a great uprising of their own. Still largely independent, the recent deaths of a number of Welsh kings had led to this great unrest there. And a rebellion was led forward by a number of the remaining princes. The kingdoms of Gwynedd and Powys became these centres for power within the disparate areas of Wales. And whilst the small armies lacked the ability to realistically take on the might of the crown and the armies of King John, they did indeed succeed in this treaty of peace, which allowed them greater independence and much less involvement in the nation by John and by the government and by the crown and the King of England. And by the crown of England. By 1214, John was finally ready for his campaign into Normandy. Ruling barons had repeatedly delayed it for years prior, but in February of that year, the time had come. It started well, but King Philip of France took strategic victories, and after some really tough fighting in northern France, John was forced to retreat, and by that October, was back home again. His great plan, years in the making, ending fruitless. The barons of England had seen enough. They'd been planning a rebellion for some time, and now their time had come. They renounced their ties with the king and appointed Robert Fitzwalter as their new chosen military leader. They called themselves the Army of God, and they began to march on London, seizing it first before also taking Lincoln and Exeter too, attracting more and more defectors from the crown as they went, increasing their numbers significantly. King John had no choice but to call a negotiation. He met the rebellion at Runnymede, a meadow near Windsor Castle, one of those castles that had been built by William the Conqueror that we discussed previously. The document that they would draw up between them was called the Great Charter, or in the spoken Latin of the time, the Magna Carta. It would be one of the defining moments of political and social reform, focusing on giving better rights to the people of the nation and for them to be treated as free men, to protect them from things like illegal imprisonment, to recognise the rights of the church better than they had previously, and to increase taxes only with the approval of the barons and not just on the whim of the king. Still recognised today as a symbol of liberty, it's known as one of the greatest constitutional documents to have ever existed. It's a landmark in the freedom of the individual over the power of a governing body or the crown. Only two copies of it still exist, which in itself is incredible. One's in Lincoln Cathedral and the other is in Salisbury Cathedral. Now, in return for signing the agreement, the rebel barons would agree to stand down from their war and to surrender London back to King John. However, John was far from impressed and sought the assistance from the Pope, who called the charter, and I quote, not only shameful and demeaning, but illegal and unjust, and who swiftly excommunicated these rebel barons from the church, thus starting what was known as the First Barons' War. Now, the barons began this war well, taking Rochester, but John had a vast army, and he had vast funds for paying mercenaries to fight on his behalf, and he separated the barons of the north from the south, preventing them from fighting together. John retook Rochester in what was described as one of the most sophisticated, hard-fought sieges of any place at any time. John took down the barons one by one, reclaiming the land that they'd taken, sieging their own lands before pushing north up into Scotland, where the Scottish King Alexander II had also aligned himself with this rebellion. The rebel barons invited Philip of France to invade in order to support them and their cause, which would divert John's attentions back to the south again, dragging him back out of the lands of Scotland. And so John spent the year, the war was from 1215 to 1217, he spent that year marching his armies around the country to reclaim the land, to fight for the land and the castles which were being taken in the name of this army of God, who were also now fighting with the French, the Scottish, and these knights of the church too. In 1216, John fell sick. And whilst riding across the Wash, this great inlet, the estuary at the north of modern-day Norfolk across into Lincolnshire, he lost a considerable amount of his belongings, including many of his crown jewels, and also, it's believed, the actual crown, into the whirlpools and the quicksand of the land there, of the terrain there. His sickness grew worse, and by the time they reached Newark Castle in Nottinghamshire, he was unable to continue, dying on the evening of the 18th of October. His son, Henry III, was to succeed him on the throne, crowned at only 9 years old. A council was created to rule on behalf of this nine-year-old king, whose land was still being overrun by these rebelling barons in the midst of the war. And his mother, John's widow, requested that he be placed under the command of William Marshall, 1st Earl of Pembroke, who was this statesman and one of the most famous knights in all of England. The situation that Henry inherited was not a great one by any means. Half his land on these shores was still occupied and overrun by these rebels, these barons who were refusing the authority of the crown. And most of John's land on the continent had fallen back to the French. And all this was facing a nine-year-old, which is incredible. However, he had the full support of the Catholic Church, of the Pope. And at his coronation, at which he used one of his mother's crowns, indeed, as I said, John had lost the crown into the Wash of Norwich, Henry declared himself a crusader, like his family before him, and he therefore gained complete protection from the holy armies of the Pope. Henry attempted to negotiate peace, to offer the barons a way out, to give them back their land in return for a peace agreement, and he even redrew the Magna Carta with these changed and amended clauses, but still it failed. However, when the battle was reframed to be a holy war, with the young Henry fighting on behalf of the cross, it caused many from the side of the barons to defect over to the side of the crown, and ultimately began to swing the war in his favour. Louis of France split his forces into two, heading north and taking Lincoln Castle, and the other half coming south to take Dover Castle. Now, William Marshall, this great knight who was acting on behalf of the new king, saw this as a chance to take the war in a single movement, capitalizing on these two half armies. And so on the 20th of May, they entered Lincoln, sacking the buildings and retook the city, arresting many of the senior rebels in the process. French reinforcements began to arrive, but a fleet was sent south to meet them, and they scattered the invading French, sinking their ships and executing their captains. With the war for the rebels and the French lost, Philip entered new peace talks, and the Treaty of Lambeth was drawn up to end the First Barons' War. Henry's government was largely unsuccessful in its early years. The country was in turmoil, and despite the peace, the ruling barons were still ignoring much of the royal law, living in illegally constructed castles called adulterine castles, which were without royal license. However, in 1220, the Pope agreed to crown Henry a second time using a new set of royal regalia, which was aimed to affirm better the powers of the crown of Henry, and shortly after, the barons agreed to give back the castles and to pay their outstanding debts on threat of excommunication from the church by the Pope, who of course was in line with King Henry. When the English king was called upon to send auxiliary troops to France to defend Gascony, he pulled together a significant force to cross the Channel to assist, which drew on the support of these previously revolting barons. And the area of Gascony was quickly defended, though in return for their support of Henry's army, the barons demanded the reissue again of the Magna Carta, the Great Charter, to which the king agreed. So the young King Henry gave this new version of the document his royal approval, the royal seal. The content was largely the same as the previous version, the main difference being that this one had that official royal seal, this royal approval. However, Henry at the time was still classed as a minor in England, despite himself being king. In 1227, when he finally became an adult and was able to take the rule of the nation for himself, he put forth that all charters could only be issued under the royal seal, under his own royal seal, thus throwing into dispute the legality of the previous one, which was of course issued under the seal of the king as a minor. Henry largely followed the rules and the statutes set out in the Magna Carta, and he ruled accordingly. Whilst he was able to rule for himself at this stage, he lacked any real ability to do so appropriately, and his reign became careless. He was arrogant militarily, yet quite cowardly at the same time. He was very ambitious, yet extremely impractical in his methods. In the 1230s, he drew together gatherings in the court to assess laws and the rule of the land, and the first use of the word parliament comes from this time, used to describe these courtroom meetings. The word comes from the French parlement, parler being to talk, and these parliamentary gatherings would become a staple of Henry's reign, used to discuss and agree on topics such as taxes, and eventually each county would send delegates to these parliaments to act on their behalf. By the late 1250s, Henry's reign was in trouble once more. The barons had begun to revolt once more, unhappy at the way that the crown was acting with certain things such as raising funds. They were unhappy at certain influences within the court, within the parliament, who were making decisions with this disproportionate amount of power. And even the church was starting to voice grievances over its own treatment by the king. The lands of Wales and Scotland, always wild and independent, had begun to join forces too. And the king was out of money. He was running up great debts to the church, and behind his back, a mutiny was forming. Seven of the most senior barons formed an alliance, and in April 1258, marched into the sitting parliament whilst it was in session and carried out a coup d'etat. Fearing the worst, Henry immediately agreed to rule and govern through a council of 24 councilmen only. The agreement was that these members would be chosen by both the barons and the king. This proved somewhat of an empty promise, however, and the dispute over who would sit on these councils, who would sit in these parliaments, eventually led to the Second Barons' War in 1264. This time, however, the barons were led by the powerful Simon de Montfort. De Montfort sought to wipe out all evidence of any of the barons' existing debts, and in doing so massacred through the Jewish population and wiped out entire towns of people, including across the land of Wales. In 1265, the parliament sat for the very first time in the Palace of Westminster, known as de Montfort's Parliament, which included elected officials of the towns and cities across the country. Despite Parliament sitting before this time, this was largely regarded as the first sitting of the English Parliament. Now, the power in the land swung back and forth over the ensuing years, with gains being made by both the king's forces and these baronial forces of de Montfort, leading on the 4th of August 1265 to the Battle of Evesham. De Montfort's army was vastly outnumbered and vastly outmaneuvered by that of the king, and by the end of the day, a group of 12 knights, acting independently from the charge of the pack, stalked the battlefield with the sole aim of bringing de Montfort down. They tracked him down on the field, circled around him so that he couldn't escape, and killing him with a lance through the neck. It was written that the day should be called the Murder of Evesham, for battle it was not. Henry used the victory to reorganize, and whilst he was initially quite brutal in his sequestering of rebel lands, he did eventually return the lands to the barons in return for payment of these incredibly harsh fines. In his final years, the final years of his reign, he was growing increasingly weak and senile and infirm, and most of his remaining time was spent securing peace there in his own land and maintaining this peace that he'd strived for. And maintaining this peace that he'd sought for so long, and on his own devotions to the church and to his religion. Despite showing intentions of joining the next crusade, this very senile Henry eventually died in 1272 in Westminster. His successor, his eldest son, was Edward I. Now, when Henry died in 1272, Edward was on crusade in the Holy Land. Now, the situation in England was secure, it was stable and peaceful for the first time in many, many years, and so Edward saw no cause to hurry home and didn't actually arrive back to these shores until 1274, which was nearly 2 years later after a very leisurely journey back across the continent. One of the most defining aspects of the reign of Edward I was the conquest of Wales. Prince Llewellyn of Wales, who'd been an aggressor to much of Henry's rule, planned to further aggravate the crown by marrying Simon de Montfort's daughter, Eleanor. War was declared on Llewellyn, though support for him amongst his Welsh countrymen was actually very weak. Indeed, when the English forces arrived with 15 or 16,000 men, 9,000 or so of them were actually Welsh. There were no major battles in this war. Llewellyn surrendered almost immediately, being allowed to keep his title, which was an ongoing title, the Prince of Wales. However, a couple of years later, there was a second outbreak of war in the land. This time, the Welsh rallied together, provoked by the English imposition of law on this independent Welsh people. This time, though, the war from the English was one of conquest. By 1284, the Statute of Rhuddlan brought the Principality of Wales under English rule. Wales was given an administrative system which fell in line with the English one, and an English law was introduced in, certainly in criminal cases, though there were certain Welsh customary laws which were permitted to remain in the land. Edward began to create new settlements there, such as Flint and Aberystwyth, which were filled with English migrants and where the native Welsh were forbidden from entering and often kept out by a vast network of high walls. He embarked on an extensive project of castle building there too, in places like Beaumarie, in Anglesey, Caernarfon and Harlech. With the kings of the time, including Edward himself, having spent such a great amount of time abroad on crusade, these influences from the fortresses of overseas were beginning to find their way back to Britain. These castles were built in a concentric design, in that the interior wall was constructed higher than the external wall, and so the outer wall could be defended from the inner wall. It's a design that was used in ancient Persia, in ancient Assyria, ancient Egypt for hundreds of years prior, but was very, very expensive to build, and so was restricted really to the most wealthy and powerful of military orders. So you'd be looking at the Knights of the Knights Templar, the Knights Hospitallier, or to very extremely wealthy kings. They also marked these castles, the first introduction of arrow slits in the stone walls, which would be used to defend the castle with archers and bows. Edward never again went to crusade, though he did always intend to do so, and his international aspirations played a big part in shaping his policies as King of England. In order to run an effective crusade which comprises the leaders of each nation, then it is of course important that a decent relationship exists between each of them and their lands, and alliances were made between Edward of England and King Philip of France, with Aragon, with the rulers of Italy, and with the German king too. However, his relationships with Scotland were diminishing. For much of his reign, he had actually got on well with his neighbours across the border. But when the King of Scotland, Alexander III, died in 1286, and his heir, Margaret, died shortly afterwards, Edward decided to take claim of Scotland for himself and for England, taking their coronation stone, which was known as the Stone of Destiny. It's a sandstone block which had been used for centuries for the coronations of each of the Scottish kings, and Edward took it back to Westminster Abbey, where it was fitted into a wooden chair known as King Edward's Chair. He deposed John Balliol, who was the new King of the Scots, locked him in the Tower of London, and imposed English rule over the Scottish lands. Of course, this English rule did not last long, and the Scottish resistance began, with Andrew de Moray in the northern land and William Wallace in the south, famously played by Mel Gibson in Braveheart. But the battles were long and somewhat unsuccessful for both parties, and the century drew to a cold close as the two nations embarked into a 32-year war, which would go on to be known as the First War of Scottish Independence. Next time, the heights of chivalry and the greatest decline of it too, as England falls headfirst into the Hundred Years' War, one of the greatest conflicts of the Middle Ages.